perfectly sympathize with them.
Because if I was a homeowner, I certainly wouldn't want to wreck, you know, a 73 vehicle that's falling apart in front of my home, you know. They say that motorhomes attract other motorhomes. So they won't even let this, even though this is a much nicer home than I had, I took my life savings and purchased this. It's a 97, you know, and it's much nicer than the other motorhomes that you see. I'm actually king of the motorhomes now. But, you know, still, they don't want you around. They just don't want it.
And that's David Sterner at his RV on a street in Glassell Park, talking to KCRW's Saul Gonzalez about how locals don't want homeless people living in cars and RVs on their street. Last year, a federal appeals court struck down an LA ordinance prohibiting people from living in their vehicles. In their ruling, judges described the law as an invitation to discriminate against the poor. Now the city attorney, Mike Feuer, has written two amended versions of the ordinance for consideration by the city council. Mike Feuer joins me now. And in a moment, we'll also talk with attorney Carol Sobel, who represented a group of homeless in their suit against the previous ordinance, the one that the court struck down. But first, Mike Feuer, welcome to the show.
Barbara, great to be with you.
So why did the court strike down the previous ordinance? Could you flesh out their objections
sure.
for us?
Sure. Basically, the court said that the previous ordinance was too vague. It didn't give enough specific direction as to what would be unlawful activity and what was lawful. And after the court issued that ruling, I made the choice not to appeal the ruling, not to litigate further an old ordinance, and said instead that I thought that it was possible for us to find alternatives that would strike the right balance, that would assure that we were protecting the rights of people who are homeless and at the same time promoting the quality of life that all of us would like in our neighborhoods. And we've given the council a couple alternatives that would succeed at doing just that.
And how do they differ from the one that the court struck down?
Well, one approach is quite different. One approach that we've offered to the council is to allow for there to be sleeping in cars on a limited basis. There would be a ban on doing so in residential neighborhoods, but the council could identify some commercial locations in which sleeping in cars could be permissible. We suggest to the council that if it were to do so, it accompany that approach with a requirement that people taking advantage of it also take advantage of services to benefit homeless people and have a tag of some sort on their vehicle that would indicate they've done that. The other approach is to fashion an ordinance that would restrict people from sleeping in their cars altogether. It would just be a more specific version of the previous ordinance.
Because that was the vagueness problem,
correct.
Right? What constitutes living in your car?
Exactly.
How did you address that?
Well, in a way that would define lodging in a vehicle as being engaged in one of a couple different activities at the same time. There'd be indicia of lodging in a car would include storing within your car material not normally associated with a car. Sleeping bags, bedrolls, cooking equipment, bottles to store bodily fluids, other kinds of possessions, along with sleeping or cooking or preparing meals in a vehicle. So we're making clear that it's not simply someone pulling over to the side of the road for an hour, but rather really engaging and lodging in a vehicle. And the council can make a policy choice as to whether it wants to perpetuate the old approach, which was to ban this practice altogether, or to create an opportunity for people who are homeless to have a location in which they could sleep in their cars in some neighborhoods in a city, but they would not be residential areas.
And what's the rationale for why we need this ordinance? What problems is the city trying to solve or avoid? And isn't there an argument that if there were more low-income housing and homeless services available, you wouldn't need to address the problem you would be able to address the problem in a more direct way?
Well, let's start there, because I couldn't agree more. That to address issues relating to homelessness through the lens of the criminal justice system is the wrong approach, because we ought to be taking steps at a much earlier stage. We ought to be trying to address the issues that create homelessness at the front end of the process. The depth of the homeless problem in the city, the fact that so many people have no place to live, is a disgrace. And all of us at every level of government need to be doing more than has been done in past decades to address it. I have very strong views about that and completely agree that we ought not be relegating ourselves to simply looking at how to restrict certain activity once someone has become homeless. So I think the city needs to be, for example, promoting much more permanent supportive housing. As you know, the population of people who are homeless is a very complex and heterogeneous population, right? There are single moms who can't afford first and last month's rent. There are mentally disabled people. There are people who are recovering from alcohol or drug addiction. And each of these groups of people who are homeless and others who simply because of economic circumstances find themselves on the street need different kinds of services. And I think that we need to have a much more nuanced, effective policy to grapple with the conditions that create homelessness in the first place. Having said that, there are nonetheless issues that that we have to contend with in the meantime. But I think that the focus needs to be placed properly on effectively addressing the causes of homelessness and finally committing ourselves to ending it.
Mike Feuer, I know you need to leave us, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time on the show.
Thanks. Barbara, really appreciate it.
Thanks again. In a moment, we'll bring on attorney Carol Sobel. But first, let's hear a little more from David Stirner, who lives in his REV here in L.A. He spoke with KCRW's Saul Gonzalez.
I'm retired. I used to take care of fish ponds. And so now money is tight, so I can't afford rent. So I bought this RV, you know, years ago.
And you've been living in it how long, approximately?
2 years, this particular one.
What is that like in the city of L.A., living in an RV for that length of time?
Well, basically, you get chased around a lot. You get constantly chased. There's nowhere for us to be.
And sometimes the cops are cool and sometimes they aren't. And...
yeah, most of the time they're not. They do write summonses. I got a $70 ticket a few days ago. And that puts more of a burden. And actually, in effect, he's slowing me down. He's preventing me from complying. I want to get out of here. But when I get so stressed out, it's actually a physical drain on me. I get ill. And it totally debilitates me from being able to actually comply with his wishes.
Finally, I mean, do you feel camaraderie with others who live in RVs and in some automobiles and all? Do you feel like you're, you're not in homes, but you're not homeless either? Do you feel like you're doing kind of your own thing?
Yeah, well, here I meet a lot of friends, and most of them are veterans. I'm a United States Air Force Vietnam vet, and I feel I paid my dues to my country, but yet I'm not wanted here any longer. It's kind of a sad situation.
Is it, at times, a satisfying life? Is it, do you have everything you need? Do you?
No, it's not that rewarding a life, actually. It's a hard life. You know, you're constantly running out of things like fuel, water, food, and removing your waste. All these are problems which normally the city takes care of if you pay rent.
David Stirner from his RV in Glassell Park. We're talking about L.A. creating a new ordinance to prohibit people living in their cars or RVs on the city streets. Carol Sobel joins me now. As I mentioned earlier, she's an attorney. She represented a group of homeless in the suit that brought down the previous city ordinance. And Carol, good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Well, first, what's your reaction to the city trying to put a new version of this ordinance in place?
Well, I think it's short-sighted. I heard Mike Feuer's presentation, and we agree on the long-term solution. The issue is, what is the short-term solution here? And let me just say that the ordinance that the reason we struck down that ordinance or moved to strike down that ordinance was the city had targeted the Venice area, which has probably 1 in 8 of the vehicles of people, or at that time, had 1 in 8 of the vehicles of people living in their vehicles. And most people, a lot of people don't live in RVs. People who, you know, for one reason or another got sick, lost their rent, lost their apartment, and are living in a little car. So it's not quite this picture of everybody living in a vehicle. But so the city had this proposal called Street to Homes, and they were going to find safe parking places for people and be able to have people get services and do all of that. In the months before they started arresting people, they were unable to find a single place in the city where they could have people who were living in their vehicles park safely. And they were looking to get them off the residential streets. So the first proposal was to allow nighttime parking at the beach parking lots, which are leased to the county, and the county said no.
Permitting idea, though? It's early yet. We don't know all the details. So, but do you see any merit in this revised approach?
Because it's a response
to getting shot down
right.
on making an agreement with the county.
Right. I think there are two issues, Barbara. One is that the city, for the last couple of months since this ordinance was struck down, has been on a very, very intense campaign to rezone a lot of the city to exclude it. So the areas where there's solely commercial property is very limited in this city. So you're not going to be able to really have a realistic program, and it's nowhere near where you get services. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is the fact that you can't get services. A lot of the people who live in their vehicles, as Mr. Stirner said, would love to be housed but can't afford it. So there's no reaching out to people anyway. There's no housing available in this city. Every day, you know, we hear stories about the lack of housing for homeless people, for low-income people, for middle-class people. So it is an intense problem that needs to be solved at its root.
And in terms of the short-term problem, what is your response to concerns by local residents who take issue with people living in vehicles on their streets?
I think that there are a number of things that the city could do short-term. You know, we have empty buildings in this city, empty parking lots because of public buildings not being used. We could identify places where people can park at night, be off residential streets. The beach parking lots were perfect because there are public bathrooms there. And we basically need the county and the city to come together and say, this is our long-term problem. Here is our short-term solution to that problem that is going to take into consideration protecting people who live in their vehicles because they can't afford to live elsewhere and people who live in the residences. And I think the really important thing is we need an approach that doesn't make criminals out of people who are homeless, because every time we do that, we limit their ability to come back into society because we've now created black marks for them. We've got criminal records for people, which precludes them from certain housing opportunities. You know, landlords run these. It's all counterproductive.
Well, looking forward, as you are now, it's hard to estimate, it's hard to figure out how many people are living in their vehicles in the city, but the LA's Homeless Services Authority estimates about 5,000 people.
I think the current estimate is 8,000, actually.
What happens to those people if and when the city does pass another ordinance against this?
They're going to get arrested and taken to jail like my clients were. They're going to have their vehicles impounded like my clients did. They're going to lose all of their possessions like some of my clients did. And they're not going to get any services. And that's really the tragedy here. You know, but all of the people who actually sued about this issue in my case, aren't all housed now. But it took some of them 2 years of being on a waiting list to get housed. We need to not make people criminals in that time period. So I think the city needs to think harder and work with the county and say, look, we don't want to put people in jail, but we want to address the problems of residential neighborhoods as well. We have got to, as a short term, open up our public parking lots at night. We can put in public toilets. We can reduce the impact on neighborhoods and protect people who have no choice but to live in their vehicles.
Attorney Carol Sobel, thank you very much for being on the program. I appreciate it. Well, press players, what's your reaction to this issue? Have you had concerns about homeless people living in vehicles in your neighborhood? You can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play, and we might read your comments or play them on the air later on. Coming up, he was the 1950s water evangelist who basically argued, if we sprinkle it, they will come. And come they did. Now the son is trying to solve the problems of the father, the saga of Pat and Jerry Brown. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Governor Jerry Brown imposed statewide mandatory water cutbacks this week. California residents, now in their fourth year of drought, have to cut back water usage by 25%. And we were talking about this on the show yesterday. But the drought can't take all the blame for our water woes. You can trace some of our problems back to Governor Brown's father, former Governor Pat Brown. Back in the 50s, Pat Brown lobbied for a water system that would set the stage for a population explosion in Southern and Central California. The system pumped water from Northern California to thirstier parts of the state, and people followed the water, creating a boom that could go bust in current conditions. William Carl is the author of Water and Power and the California Water Atlas. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Barbara, thank you so much for calling. How can I help you?
Well, you can, because I just gave the simplest, oversimplified explanation of how our water comes from Northern California. Could you fill that in for us briefly, though, how California's water system works?
Well, let's talk specifically about what Pat Brown added to the system, which was the California Aqueduct and a large addition in storage called the San Luis Reservoir, which was built after his, but it was part of the whole system. It brings water from Northern California down past the Bay Area and then into the Central Valley of California and then on into the whole Southern California metropolis. And so to a large extent, your listeners are both the beneficiaries, and I suppose in the context we're talking about today, to some extent, the victims of that success.
And what was the range of goals that Pat Brown wanted to achieve by creating this state water project?
Well, the function of the process, we live in a state that is dependent upon a natural supply to a large extent. We're blessed that we have a lot of water in the state, and it's inside our own borders. But it comes in, you can't tell what's going to happen from one year to the next, because it depends entirely upon how much water falls on us, as snow and rain. And as the governor was explaining in the connection with the bonds last November, some years we have plenty of water and some years we don't. So the function of the system is to give us the flexibility to smooth out those peaks and valleys in water supply. Most of California's rivers, or many of them at least, would run dry, for example, during the summer months in their natural condition. But instead, we've created a system that enables us to move water around in the state to get it to where it's needed when it's needed. And that's really the function of the process.
And as you and many others have pointed out, now we got this water system that enabled the kind of growth that we've had over the last 50 years in the southern part of the state, in the desert. And whenever I hear the story, I think, what was the alternative? How might history have evolved differently?
Well, you wouldn't have had Los Angeles.
Well, yes, but, you know, someone else could have come along and taken up his
cause. God never intended large numbers of people to live on the South Coast plain because it's a semi-arid area. If you listen to people in Northern California, they all should have stayed up there. People who say those people in Los Angeles shouldn't be there, it's hard to have. That's not a conversation that leads anywhere.
Not a conversation that has two sides, you're saying. Well, a lot of water historians say that this current water crisis was years and years in the making. When Pat Brown put his system into place, do you think anyone could have possibly have foreseen a day that California would run out of water?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's part of the variability of the system. But let's talk for a minute about some of the consequences of the system that the father built that the son is now wrestling with, because that's such a rich and poignant kind of question.
And ironic.
Well, there is a certain irony. And I can think of, you know, three major consequences of the development of the system that Pat advocated. And the first is that it's linked the parts of the state together in a condition of mutual dependency that never existed before. It used to be, for example, if Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, made a mess of their water system, that was their problem. But today, if Los Angeles, for example, as it has, says, okay, we're going to put water back into the Owens Valley, or we're going to, you know, take less from the Owens Valley, that just increases pressure on the delta at the northern end of the state, because Los Angeles control water from there. As a result, we're all in a situation where we can't afford anyone to be really irresponsible or wasteful in the use of water. And so it's those linkages that also makes it much harder, I think, for any of us, and particularly for a governor like, you know, the current governor is facing. You don't get to throw anyone under the bus. You don't get to say, we don't care what happens to them. We have to use the system to try to, and use its power to try to get water to sustain the state as best we can. And I think, you know, the second obvious consequence, and you've pointed it out, is that the development of Pat Brown's system brought millions of people into the state. It creates whole new industries. It creates huge communities, you know, where lots and lots of people live and who are totally dependent upon that system. And one of the options we don't have is saying, okay, go back where you came from. Sorry, it was a bad idea. And I would say the third big consequence is not so much what Pat Brown built, but what he left out. Because if you're going to, you know, capture water in the north and bring it south, you need to bring it through a secure system that protects the quality of the water, so that, you know, you're not polluting the drinking water supply for 25 million people. Instead, because of a political deal at the time in the late 1950s, instead of bringing it through in a closed system, they decided to filter the water or run the water supply for what is now 27 million people through a rapidly deteriorating bog, the San Fernando San Joaquin Delta, which was a degraded environment and that has fallen, you know, has been declining dramatically ever since, and caused us to try to operate what is in nature a saline estuary as if it were a freshwater estuary. And the consequences have been very bad, both for the environment and for the people who are dependent upon that water supply. For one thing, you have to spend a tremendous amount of money to clean the water back up by the time it gets to Southern California.
Just to finish up, and it's an impossible task, but in 30 seconds, what do you think then the moral of this story is? And as you're pointing out, it's so rich, this tale. Is it a story of the sins of the father, or does it say more about our state, our unique state of California?
I think it says a lot about the unique state of the uniqueness of the of California's experience. It consists in our ability to operate collaboratively. This is not a one-industry state. The water system is a perfect example of how you bring very different communities and a wide range of sciences and expertise and industries into a single system and make them work together for the benefit of all. That's been our strength. It's a strength that you see reflected in the film industry, in aerospace, in the development of the Silicon Valley, where mature industries all work together as best we can. And there's more of that in the operation of the water system than anywhere else in our lives.
I knew you'd rise so well to that challenge. Bill Carl, he's the author of Water and Power and the California Water Atlas. It is always a joy to talk with you, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, coming up, Helen Mirren fighting to regain a Klimt painting of her aunt, or Furious 7. For some, it might not be so hard a choice. How to spend Saturday night at the movies. Our film guys have advice. That's after the news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play, a Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Must one be both fast and furious? Well, now we've had seven blockbuster movies worth of time to ponder this question, and the answer, somehow they still remain elusive. Perhaps the latest installment in the franchise, Furious 7, will provide answers this weekend. And to talk about that and all the new releases, Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap, and Dave White, film critic for Movies.com, are here. Together, they host the Linoleum Knife podcast, my favorite name for a podcast. Really nice to have you both here.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Okay. As promised, first up today, Furious 7. It's the seventh installment of the Fast and Furious series. Here's a clip from the movie.
How about you tell us where that device is?
I mailed it to a friend in Abu Dhabi.
That was pretty easy. That other team would have tortured you for that information.
I didn't trust them. I trust you.
Now, why would you trust us? You barely know us.
Life is binary. Zeros and ones. Only two things keep a group like this together, fear or loyalty. And I don't see a drop of fear among you guys.
And of course, this is the clip in which we learn that the crew aren't friends, they're family.
Surprise, surprise. It's mentioned about 80 times per movie, just in case we'd missed that.
Well, what's the difference this time? What do they get into?
Well, this time, what's interesting about this series is that it started out being about, you know, car theft and drag racing. And then
Which is plenty. That's enough.
You can totally do. And then somewhere around the fifth installment, although they set it up a little in the third one. This basically became the Avengers. This is a superhero movie without masks and capes, but it is as logic and gravity defying as anything based on a Marvel comic, and more the better for it, I think.
Well, judging from the trailer, too, for this new one, that's what it looks like, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first couple films they took themselves very seriously, and I'm not going to go retrofit my opinions. I didn't dig those first couple movies. It wasn't until Tokyo Drift that the director, Justin Lin, came along and sort of visually and cinematically re-jump-started everything, for me anyway. And from that moment on, it became much more fun, much more loose, and
four backslides,
But as time has gone on, the characters have become much more lovable and much more like funny with each other.
They've become characters.
And the yes, exactly.
In other words.
And the situations, as ludicrous as they are, no pun intended, but they're thrilling. It's thrilling to watch this human cartoon. And I've heard recently in the past few days a lot of people talking to, you know, film critics give these movies a pass. But I don't think that's accurate.
I don't think it's fair. They're thrilling and fun, and that's an amazing combo.
We are human beings like everyone else. And to watch, you know, this extravagant, explodey nonsense is deeply satisfying.
And that does bring me to the question, the more serious question in all of this, which is, of course, that actor Paul Walker passed away during the filming of this movie.
Yes.
So, and as we've said, it's the operative word is fun in the later installments. So how well, first of all, did they piece together a story arc for his character using footage?
He exists very successfully in the film. It doesn't feel like there's this sudden awkward disappearance or whatever. I mean,
it's not Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Exactly.
You know, like Bela Lugosi dies in the middle. And
no one's holding a cape in front of their face and pretending to be Paul Walker. Oddly enough, it adds a weird level of reality to the proceedings in that before you would watch these insane stunts and these crazy explosions. And because, as you said, it's a cartoon, you don't really think about there being consequences. And this movie, you constantly think, oh, are they going to kill Paul Walker's character after this one? Is he going to survive this jump or this stunt?
Right, yeah. Because he died in a car wreck.
And, so, and you don't yeah. know when he, how they're going to get him out of this movie or how they're going to get him out of the franchise. And I don't want to spoil how they do it, but they do it very well.
It's
and,
very – the way they have handled a real-life intrusion of death is in keeping with the way they've done things in the past in the films and satisfying as well. I feel about the Fast and Furious – films the way I feel about Downton Abbey. It could go on forever and I would be happy.
I didn't think that sentence was going to end that way.
Yes. I know that Downton Abbey is going to end soon and that makes me cry inside a little bit. But I could watch it for the rest of my life. Yeah, I could grow old with those people and I feel the same way about the Fast and Furious
If
people.
Matthew from Downton Abbey had been in the Fast and Furious movies, he would have survived that car accident. That's all I'm saying.
That's true. Well, moving on, we have to move on from Fast and Furious to Slow and Austrian. Woman in Gold is the story of a famous Gustav Klimt painting that ended up in the center of an international court case. It stars Helen Mirren and Ryan Reynolds. And we have a clip.
My aunt, Adele. My uncle commissioned Gustav Klimt to paint her.
That's quite a painting.
It's magnificent. She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. And since then, she's been hanging in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Wouldn't that be lovely? And the whole the plot, what's this one about?
You just heard
Kevin. That's it. Yeah. It's,
the whole thing is about this woman, Maria Altman, whose aunt
lived
was
in
the
Los
subject.
Angeles for decades.
Yes. She had fled the Nazis, got out of Austria with her husband, who was an opera singer, and after the death of her sister, decided to fight the Austrian government to get the Klimt painting back that the Nazis had seized from her family, and contacts a lawyer who's a family son of a family friend, Randy Schoenberg, who's the grandson of the legendary composer, and whose father was a judge. And so he's sort of trying to prove himself. And, you know, she has this crusade. It's a fascinating story. I wish that the movie were at the level of the real story that it's telling, because, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, but fiction has a way of smooshing the truth into very kind of convenient grooves. So I felt like I was watching, I felt like I'd seen this sort of underdogs versus the man story before, the, you know, Nazi occupation and, you know, the family driven out escape story. I mean, these are all, I'm sure the things that happened to Marie Altman were fascinating and compelling tales.
And there are books written on this very
exactly,
subject.
Which have been told in nonfiction very well. This movie smooshes them all into a very kind of cozy familiarity. And the only thing I came out of this movie really appreciating was Helen Mirren's performance. She's dynamite. Ryan Reynolds is not, unfortunately. I like him in a lot of other things, but not here.
Well, I don't envy anyone going up against Helen Mirren, but Ryan Reynolds, he just doesn't seem to me the epitome of a lawyer.
He wears
lawyer.
A very large pair of glasses.
Oh, well.
And so,
there you go.
Boom.
I'm, you know, in general, I'm a fan of Mr. Reynolds.
Yes, same
here.
In comedy, definitely, he knows his stuff.
And I have this thing where I don't ever really blame the actors. I blame directors and editors almost always. I'll take the actor's side over everything.
That's a very generous
nine
view.
Takes, right?
How sure.
Like, let's say that's the average. Somebody picked the wrong take.
And Dame Hill and next it out in yeah. one. It's like, okay, we're moving on. Wait, but I
think
but
I blame
she's
the
reason
director.
To see this film. She is watchable in everything and anything. And she brings everything she's got, even to a film that isn't up to her. If you are interested in this in a real way, there's a book about this very case called The Woman in Gold. Now, the movie itself is just called Woman in Gold. And then there's a book called The Rape of Europa that was about the larger picture of Nazi art theft. And that itself became
book.
a documentary in 2006. Mm-hmm. So there's so much information about this and in this particular case, this particular painting. If you really want to know about that stuff, that's kind of where you go. And if you just want to watch Helen Mirren be awesome, then fine. You know, watch this movie too, I guess.
Okay, last new release of the week. It's a Hungarian film called White God. It's a pretty amazing trailer, I have to say, featuring what looks like, I don't know, a takeover of a whole city by dogs. Alonso, what's going on?
Oh,
here?
I thought we were
going
to have a clip of.
Believe me, we considered it.
It is akin to Rise of the Planet of the Apes in a way. It is about a dog that leads a rebellion of dogs in the middle of Budapest. It's a compelling film. A young girl, her parents are divorced. Her mother is going off to Australia for a few months, and she has to live with her father. She has this dog that she that she's sort of adopted, and apparently there's some weird rule that and this may just be something made up for the film, that if it's not a pure Hungarian breed you have to pay this fine, and the father refuses to pay it because he's mad at the mother, and they wind up having to abandon the dog. So the daughter is distraught, and the dog just goes from bad situation to worse until finally he reaches the breaking point. This is the kind of movie that allows you to put any kind of metaphorical read on it, from how Jews were treated in Eastern Europe during the 30s, to how we treat the environment, to how we treat our dogs, for that matter. It is, if you are the kind of person that gets upset about animal cruelty in a movie, like I had friends who wouldn't see Inside Llewyn Davis until I assured them that nothing bad happened to the cat. you might rethink whether or not you want to see this, because I mean I have a pretty high bar for that kind of thing, and I was getting upset by
this
film.
Well, it looks violent.
Yeah, the dog suffers a lot, obviously the dogs have their day. But it is so powerful and just riveting, and you really don't know where it's going to go, and the dog acting is superior, I have to say.
Should the Oscars create a Best Supporting Animal category?
If they didn't for Uggy, they should do it now. Because, that lead dog is so charismatic, and he's even got this sort of sidekick, second banana character actor, Eve Arden dog with him, It's I really, really recommend White God.
The dogs in law.
Exactly. As long as you're not going to be super upset about seeing a dog treated badly.
Okay, well, lastly, we do have a news item. It looks like there's a live-action version of Winnie the Pooh in the offing.
I don't understand that
at
all.
Well, talk about taking on a sacred cow.
Well, what I think is fascinating about this, it's going to be written and directed by Alex Ross Perry, who gave us Listen Up, Philip and The Color Wheel, which are two great indie films of recent years, but dark films about awful people. And so I find him to be a fascinating choice for this. In fact, I tweeted yesterday that I thought maybe this was a slightly old April Fool's gag. And he tweeted me back saying, nope, not really. It's really happening.
Very straight face.
Yeah. And according,
maybe he'll get inside the mind of Eeyore.
Well, according to him, it's going to be along the lines of Paddington in terms of how it's going to be live action. So I imagine
promises a lot.
Sure. Yeah. So the animals, I guess, will be CG and interacting with human beings. And Paddington was great. And
I don't believe in pre-freaking out about something. And so the fact that Winnie the Pooh is such a like you said earlier, a sacred children's object, I don't think we should be too concerned about this. I want to see what happens. And you know what? If it turns out really cool and interesting, then that's great. And if it doesn't, then we've still got 2011's beautiful.
Oh yeah, the animated one,
the animated Winnie the Pooh feature that I assume was some sort of attempt to reboot the animated version.
Yeah, very few people saw it, unfortunately.
It didn't get seen by a lot of folks. It was
delightful,
lovely.
Lovely,
if you have little
movie.
Children, if you have little children, but have them watch that one.
And if you do not have children, you should watch Listen Up, Philip and the Color Wheel. this is whatever he does with Winnie the Pooh is going to be a 180, I would imagine, from the tone of those films. But they're great.
Well, the opportunity to see Heffalumps and Weasels.
Yes.
And Tigger
reinterpreted. I mean, they're kind of the Teletubbies of the Acid Casualty set.
Right.
The Acid Casualties are all watching Adventure Time now anyway. So.
Oh, that's true. And Archer. So.
As long as Eeyore remains intact, because he's my jam. So.
Gotcha. Dave White is the film critic for Movies.com. Alonzo Duraldi is chief film critic for The Wrap. And together they host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Thanks so much for doing this. It was great. I hope you guys have a great weekend.
Thank you too.
Warren Olney is here to fill us in. What's coming up?
Hello there. Well, we're going to talk about the Iranian deal from both and hear about it from both Tehran and Washington, and what's in store for the next 30 days or 3 months, rather, I should say, until June 30th. But then we're also going to talk about free range parenting and how it's running into the nanny state.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm right there with you. Okay. That's coming up at 1. But everybody stick around for us. Coming up, 2 words, final 4. Jason Sklar of the Sklar Brothers joins us for all things sports. And that's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand. Let's talk sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
What a weekend. The NCAA Final Four is upon us. The NBA season is winding down. And opening season of baseball, thank the Lord, is around the corner. Jason Sklar, one half of the Sklar Brothers, Jason and Randy Sklar, is here with us. Welcome to the show, Jason.
It's so good to be here. This is a very exciting time for sports. I know we say that a lot, but we actually are at a great moment in sports.
Yeah, we really are. And I'm going to control my baseball enthusiast.
I know you're Red Sox Nation.
That's
I
right,
know
blah,
that.
Blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yes.
But we got to talk about Final Four. We have matchups between Kentucky and Wisconsin, Michigan State and Duke. So just how excited should we be for the rematch between Kentucky and Wisconsin, given the awesomeness of last year's tournament?
Last year's game between Wisconsin and Kentucky was an epic game. It was incredible. And I think Wisconsin's better this year. And I think Kentucky's better this year. Randy and I had a chance before last season when we went down to Kentucky, to Lexington, to perform. We have some friends who are part of Kentucky Sports Radio, which is the biggest podcast there, sports podcast. And they brought us to a closed-door practice for the Kentucky Wildcats. And last year's team, we watched that practice, and we were like, this team is amazing. They didn't live up to the hype in the regular season, but then they turned it on in the tournament last year. They got to the final game. They almost won. They lost to Connecticut. Now they are back. A lot of the kids who they thought were going to be one and done after 1 year in the NBA, a lot of them stayed. They have a set of twins on their team, which I think is fantastic, and as a twin. And they're amazing this year. Wisconsin has arguably the player of the year in college basketball, Frank Kaminsky, who's a 7-foot-1 guy who also can shoot three-point shots. He can play from outside, from inside. He's a great defender. What's amazing about this game is that Wisconsin is one of those teams that has the big guys that can match up with Kentucky's big guys. Willie Cauley-Stein, who's one of the big guys on Kentucky, and Karl-Anthony Towns. Those are two guys who are huge in the middle for Kentucky. They've been dominating other teams. A lot of people think that's why they were able to beat Notre Dame. But now Wisconsin matches up well against them. It's going to be a super exciting game. I'm going to go out on a limb, and a lot of people don't think this is going to happen. I think Wisconsin can upset them. I really do.
Oh, wow. You're slowing down.
I don't necessarily think part of me is excited to maybe see a team go undefeated. We haven't seen that since the late 70s, since the Indiana Hoosiers did it, Bobby Knight's team. No one's gone 40-0 because now they play more games than they used to back in the 70s. So there is a real chance. Kentucky's 2 games away. They could go 40-0, the first team to ever do that. So there's a lot of excitement around that game. On the other side of the bracket, you've got Michigan State. No one thought Michigan State would be there. It's amazing that they're an underdog in this tournament when you have Tom Izzo, one of the best coaches in college basketball.
Well, I was just going to say, you have this match of titans. You have Coach Izzo and Coach K.
Yes.
Is it equal? Is it equally hyperbolic, these two?
I mean, Coach K, some people are comparing him to John Wooden from the 1970s, the famous, one of the best coaches of all time for UCLA.
That.
Yeah. When it comes to titles, he just dominated. Some people argue the reason why he was so amazing was because he had Lou Alcindor, he had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and then he had Bill Walton. And when you had a big center way back then, you just dominated. But when you think about what Coach K has been able to do at Duke, which is, you know, a high standard educational university, that he recruits specific types of guys that work within his system. It's an amazing accomplishment what he's done. Then he went on and coached the U.S. Olympic team, and people, and he won gold medals with the Olympic team. He is arguably one of the best coaches, pro or college, that we've ever seen. But he's going up against Tom Izzo, who Izzo had a better team last year. Michigan State probably should have gone to the Final Four last year. He's doing more with less right now. He is arguably one of the best coaches ever. Everyone said the Big Ten was down this year. They got two teams in the Final Four. It is a super exciting time. If you don't follow college basketball, it's worth turning it on a little bit this weekend, because there is nothing like the excitement of the Final Four. Saturday night are those two semifinals games, and then Monday night is the finals, and it's super exciting.
Okay, you almost pulled me in.
I pulled you in.
I think you did, but I still want to talk about baseball.
I say to this audience, if you're a fan of the Alvin Ailey dance troupe,
yes,
watch college basketball and watch some of the amazing acrobatics and the jumping and the excitement that these guys do, and you will, I think, the physical specimens, the way these guys play, I've seen both. I'm a fan of both. I've been to Alvin Ailey. I love it, and I see a lot of parallels. So I'm going to say give it a try this weekend, and you will find yourself enwrapped in the excitement.
Alvin, you have chosen your simile well for this.
Thank you.
This audience.
Of course.
But it's almost opening day for the major leagues. It's in just a couple of days.
Which is great for everyone unless you're a Dodgers fan.
Exactly.
In Southern California.
Right.
And you don't have Time Warner.
70%
of us might not. I mean, it is arguably one of the worst TV deals ever made. You got lifelong Dodgers fans. There was a great, Bill Plaschke wrote a great article about a guy who's in Southern California, a guy who's a lifelong, 73 years old, lifelong Dodgers fan, and he can't see the Dodgers games. Why? Because he doesn't have Time Warner Cable. Well, some people say, well, just get Time Warner Cable and you're fine. They don't even offer it in his area. He has Cox Cable. Cox Cable doesn't.
Right, a lot of people don't have the choice.
They don't have LA Sportsnet. They don't offer it as an option. So all these games that you want to watch as Dodgers fans, you can't watch it. Now,
there's no end in sight to the TV blackout?
Right now, it doesn't look like there's an end in sight. And, you know, the Dodgers would have to ask for less money and restructure the deal so that other people can watch. But they don't seem to right now care that much about that. And that is a big issue, especially because the Dodgers are going to be great this year. Again, you have a lot of great players coming back. You have a lot of excitement around the team. Every year they get close. Maybe this will be the year that they beat my beloved Cardinals. I know that's horrible to say. In Southern California, my Cardinals always seem to beat the Dodgers when they think they're at their best. But it's an exciting time, and you just wish that the people in Southern California would have a chance, if they're not at Chavez Ravine, at the games, to be able to watch the Dodgers games.
Okay, one more question. We are going to be seeing some new rules this year. Batters can't step out of the batter's box between pitches. And my question, as a Red Sox Nation person, is what will David Ortiz do if he can't spit into his hands and clap twice?
He'll do it first. He won't do it between every pitch. But they're trying to speed up the game. They're trying to, like, they understand. It's funny because I've been a lifelong, you know, baseball fan and have gone to games my whole life, and it's changed now with like smartphones and with, you know, people get bored quickly and they want to look at something else and watch something else.
And don't you want to say to those people, is there somewhere you have to be?
I mean, you're at a game, like right. Tweeting what you just ate or Instagramming it. Come on, just watch the game. That's part of the fun of baseball. And I think, you know, what baseball, in my opinion, what they need to realize is that maybe they're going to lose at the games themselves, some of the casual fans, but I don't think they should speed up the game so much that you lose part of what makes the game great. It's America's pastime, and it is a wonderful way to spend an afternoon. And if they shrink it down to an hour and 20 minutes, I don't know. To me, you're losing something when you do that.
Getting back to basketball, the NBA season, it's almost over. Two things, the Clippers, and then we have LeBron and the Cavaliers.
The Clippers are so exciting. And what's amazing with the Clippers, they don't have home field advantage yet. They're in the fifth position. If they get to the fourth position or higher, they'll have home court advantage. They're only two games out from second place. That's how tight the race is in the West. The Houston Rockets are two games ahead of them. There's six games left to play. The Clippers have had an amazing season. They've got over 50 wins. They're kind of the reverse of the Lakers. The Lakers have 20 losses and like 20 wins and 54 losses. The Clippers are LA's team right now. And what's so exciting is you have probably one of the best point guards in the game, Chris Paul. You've got Blake Griffin back and healthy. DeAndre Jordan's having an amazing year. You got role players who are doing great things. The Clippers have a real chance to advance deep into the playoffs, and it's super exciting. On the other side of the bill, although I do think they have to beat the Golden State, and to me, Golden State is having one of those magical years. They're going to be tough to beat. Last Tuesday, they came in to the Staples Center and they beat the Clippers. And they didn't even play all their best players. So Golden State is going to be, they're going to have to get through Golden State if they want to make it to the finals. That's my opinion. On the other side of the ball, you got LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. They've been coming on playing so well together. You know, an amazing thing is an article came out where LeBron said that he has three friends in the NBA and none of them are on his team. And people were taken aback by that and say, wait a second, you don't have friends on your team? But I say, think about your work situation. How many people do you really like at work? I mean, maybe there's a guy that you would hang out with at work, but that's it. It's one of those situations where, you know, you don't have to love the people you work with. Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen did not love each other. Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant certainly did not love each other, but they still won championships
together. They're professionals.
You go to work. You go do your job.
There you go. Fair enough. Jason Sklar, he's one half of the Sklar brothers, Jason and Randy. It's always wonderful to have both of you or one of you here.
I think it's better just to have me here. That's my take.
So much. You can hear them talk sports on their podcast, Sklar Bro Country. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Dolly Myers is here. I like you, Dolly. You are professional, and I like you.
Yeah, it just so happens that I like you as well, but that that as far as the rest of the staff, I think it ends in this room.
Oh, just kidding. I'm staying in the room now. Okay, what's
okay, up? So today we explored the issue of people living in their cars here in LA. There's a new ban in the works on that. We wanted to know what listeners had to say about it. Tony Scott on Facebook says, well, if they can't live in their cars, where are they supposed to go? It's not like they choose to live there. But Paul Woyes says that there are many people living in RVs around his neighborhood. They leave their trash strewn all about the neighborhood and are incredibly loud. Paul hopes the new rules pass soon.
I feel for both sides, frankly.
It's a pretty complicated issue.
Yeah, it's very complicated, but that's it for us today. That's all we have for this week, in fact. Madeline will be back on Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave. I want to thank you all for listening. I hope you have a great weekend.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.